Hi there. Welcome to Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate your time wherever you are, whatever you're doing. Hopefully you're going to find something that's really interesting and fascinating and will spark a little bit of curiosity to set you off on a new path, or at least in maybe an alternate route or detour. Today's guest is John Kelly, and I found him on YouTube. This is where I find everybody, I guess, nowadays. It's just, I love it. He is doing a show. Now, the thing I like was he's got a radio background, so I immediately clicked with that. And the background, he has former CBS radio feature producer, and he reported details of the Iraq War 2 years before it began. We'll find out what that entails when we talk to him. He's also an expert in detecting unconscious encrypted voice communications. His site, Your Inner Voice, you can find out more about him, and you can just do YouTube or, you know, Google and find out more. But I'd rather hear it from him in person. Hey, John, thanks for giving me the time of day.
Hi, Wendy. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Or night, depending on who's listening, you know, and what time zone it's in.
There you go.
What are you, in terms of, what are you talking about on the CBS background? What were the details of the Iraq War?
Well, I conducted a study of the George W. Bush inaugural address in January 2001. And I produced results that identified specific details of the shock and awe strikes that were to take place 2 years later based on my interpretations of the president's speech played in reverse. So my claim is that unconscious communications encrypted backwards in President George W. Bush's speech, his inaugural address, actually profiled details of the Iraq War. And the president wasn't the only speaker at that event who disclosed such information in such an involuntary way. Now, listeners may feel that using such a methodology may be kind of far out and question the reliability of such a study. But we know that in sciences such as astronomy, that the principle of reflection is widely used. And we find that in the reflector telescope, whereby light from distant stars is studied not directly, but the reflection of that light is studied using a mirror within a reflector telescope. And so we're using the same principle of reflection, but we're applying it to speech sounds. And with regards to unconscious communications, many of our listeners may be familiar with such things as sleep talking.
Yeah.
With people who talk in their sleep. Of course, we recognize that incidents of sleep talking are unconscious behavior. In other words, during a sleep talking incident, the speaker themselves is not conscious of what they're saying. And in fact, their conscious mind has no control over the speech organs during such utterances. It's entirely unconscious behavior related to body language. When we talk and move our hands, it's not conscious behavior at all. So the unconscious can gain control of the speech organs under different circumstances. And I'm saying that these messages through this process of reflection are signs of unconscious behavior that reveal information that can be verified as factual. So let's listen to President George W. Bush's inaugural address, this excerpt from January 2001 that was so revealing when studied in such a way.
And to all nations, we will speak for the values that gave our nation birth.
Played in reverse, I heard the president say the words "Mission of Baghdad."
Mission of Baghdad. Mission of Baghdad. Mission of Baghdad.
No, I'm not sure, Wendy, if you're able to recognize the same sounds that I did.
Well, when you're listening close and you're looking at that in that tiny segment, it does kind of reveal or, I guess, imply that word is there. And I think you have to develop your hearing or an attunement to do that, because the more I'm relaying that or relating that, because the people I've worked with who do the ghost voices and that kind of stuff, they'll hear things immediately and some other people might not pick up on them. And then when you go back and you hear it again and again, it's like, oh, well, yeah, that was there. I just didn't hear it. My mind didn't make the connection. I think you're better at doing some of this intuitive listening than others might be. So yes, it does. You can hear that, but
in that capacity, I would be acting then as a guide for other listeners who are still cultivating or developing such skills. And we know that for people who may want to undertake a major expedition, like a climb up Mount Everest, it may not be something that they'll do solo on their first attempt. They may enlist the services of an expert guide who's familiar with the terrain. And so in that capacity, I can serve as such a guide. I can't make people hear different things, but I can certainly point out my observations in aid of others developing and cultivating the similar skill. Let's listen to the source audio where that specific clip derived from.
That gave our nation.
So the only effect or filtering that I'm conducting here is to reverse that clip. And I identify the words mission of Baghdad. As I said earlier, President George W. Bush was not the only speaker who contributed to this assessment of future events, because the pastor who gave a benediction after the president's statements also had something to say in this regard, although in such an unconscious way.
Deliver us from these and all other evils and cast our sins into your sea of forgetfulness.
And played it backwards, I heard the words missile attack.
Miss what's that?
And so when
that's pretty blatant. That one, yeah, I have to. That's kind of in your face.
So if we combine these two bits of data and try to come to some kind of conclusion with regards to what is the significance of a mission of Baghdad and a missile attack, we know from history that the inception of the Iraq War it commenced with a missile attack on Baghdad, Iraq. The geographic place name and the military strategy that was employed in the shock and awe strikes that launched the Iraq War was defined 2 years prior in these unconscious statements delivered in a sleep-talking sort of way that could be deciphered or decrypted by using the principle of reflection. And I did such a thing, and I reported this widely. The Monday following the inaugural, I began to speak on hundreds of radio shows and sharing this information with the public. And so it's a matter of public record that I issued these statements and made these claims at the time, and that history prevailed. And in fact, the mission of Baghdad, the missile attack, did turn out to be the shock and awe strikes. In January 2001, I wouldn't have been able to tell you North America, Canada and the United States would both become involved in such prolonged wars. But the indicators were there, and I did issue such reports, matter of public record. So whether or not people agree with this methodology or the claim that this is a sound method or that this is scientific, it can't be argued. It's a matter of public record that these reports were issued and done publicly and were even archived by third parties. I have the radio station air check from that Monday morning where I made these claims. So it's a matter of public record.
See, that part of it, I think there's a phrase I just ran across today and it reminded me about Joseph Campbell, who said, choose your myth. And each person here has a way of seeing and being and interacting with the world that is unique. You've tapped into something that works for you, and you've learned how to read it and how to use it, how to utilize it, how to make it clear to others. Not everybody's quite as adept at doing that. But to me, this is your way of viewing the world and your perspective, and it works for you. So I'm not going to argue with whether it's right or wrong. It's just a way that you've developed that is extremely efficient, especially when you're able to make it work in that way and say, this is what's coming, and it actually happens. So that speaks for itself.
I think that a lot of people are interested in forecasting and tools or instruments for forecasting. And this has publicly been demonstrated as an effective forecasting tool. And the reports concerning the Iraq War were simply one of dozens of reports that I issued over many years concerning international, national, regional news issues and where there was opportunity for verification. In other words, I wasn't just shooting in the dark in an entirely speculative way, but I was dealing with scenarios where there was such a thing as feedback available from the subjects themselves. And so when we think about scientific methodology, we can make claims about life on the far side of the galaxy, but our ability to go there in our lifetime and investigate and to receive feedback, on such hypotheses is limited. Whereas these speech studies, in the case of the Iraq War, within a 2-year period, feedback was available. And in other cases that I covered, the feedback came even more immediately. I've used this as a clinician extensively. And so when I'm working with the speakers themselves, I'm enabled to receive feedback from the speaker to verify the content of the messages that are reported. And it's consistently reported that the messages describe facts of that speaker's history, which have not been disclosed to any party or to only very limited numbers of parties. In other words, it's extraordinary that a clinician would be able to determine such facts of a personal history using such an abstract methodology.
Okay, now, Mike, quick question to just kind of clarify this. That wasn't the first time that you had done this. This is something you've been studying and working on for a while before you went on the radio saying, hey, this is what's going to happen.
Yes, I had actually trained in Southern California at a post-secondary vocational, and the designation for this field at that time was on a queue to be slated under clinical medicine by the Department of Labor in the United States. So there was groundwork conducted by people like Dr. Paul Ash, who had helped create the curriculum to pass the California State post-secondary vocational standings. So I gained the benefit of other people's work. I trained under individuals. I acknowledged the people who had developed this field by studying with them. But I went on to pioneer on my own and do my own grassroots work go into the community and take this specifically with the intent of reaching the public who had needs related to unresolved traumas, in a population that's affected, influenced by organizations such as the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts. Need I say more? There are major populations of individuals who have been influenced by different forms of abuse, and the resolution of those issues is a form of empowerment and enablement for the population to move forwards. Get past whatever emotional, psychological, or physical injuries they may have suffered in their lives. We can think of soldiers at war suffering from PTSD-related syndromes, while there's other populations that have been victims of different forms of abuse in our society. And they need access to services that can provide shortcuts to issues to help resolution. Conventional psychotherapies, psychiatry may need a 7-year investigative process. This process can get to catharsis in 60 to 90 minutes. So I was very enthusiastic to bring this material to the public. And I was successful in doing so to the extent that CBS and other major media gave me a tremendous access to airtime, television, international radio, BBC. For someone who was not a graduate of any journalism school, I was given extraordinary access to resources.
Well, that part is incredible. What I wanted to say real quickly is that I don't doubt that you've had an extremely helpful background to be able to give you some specifics on working with people with doing that backwards speech therapy, reverse therapy. There's a guy, David Oates, I interviewed when I was doing this show maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And it was so fascinating. The problem, it's also intimidating.
What is the nature of that intimidation?
The reverse speech, when you're talking to somebody and you're trying to make a point and you're thinking you're just totally, you're like Mr. Bush or somebody else giving a speech or having some kind of conversation, then somebody goes back and analyzes and says, oh, wow, we knew you were going to get divorced in 2004. That was long before, 2012 when it actually happened. You get my drift.
Well, I think that, what you're relating is that there's tremendous responsibility. There's a burden of responsibility that comes with knowledge. And so when we become party to different forms of knowledge, we also are then subject to moral or ethical decisions regarding our course of action, how to proceed in the face of such information. Information can be very powerful for people and can cause all kinds of different outcomes. We're naturally curious. But when we become party to certain types of knowledge, sometimes we regret that we were so acquisitive in our desire to accumulate so much knowledge. Sometimes it becomes a burden for us. And so I've over the years managed to create a way to promote these services so that those individuals who enter into the clinical work do so with full consent and a comprehensive understanding of expectations going in, and so that there's very limited aborted work. Whereas early on, these highly charged issues would emerge, and it may be difficult to manage. But I recognize the need to, once we initiate and gain access to powerful information, there's a need to process and resolve while we're working on it, to not leave ourselves dangling, to not open Pandora's box, so to speak. and create chaos. This is about creating integrity and wellness, not creating more chaos in people's lives. So information is very powerful, and there's responsibility that comes with it.
I like that, and I agree. I agree. So as you're doing an interview with somebody, do you do the reverse speech thing on them, or you just leave that for intuitive, your own gut feel?
Well, as a clinician, with the client's consent, I conduct an interview specifically for the purpose of conducting such a study. But in my day-to-day activities, I'm not engaged in some sort of mass surveillance program on a basis.
The Big Brother thing.
Unlike other major institutions to which we are subject, I am not party to those types of ethics or morals that would trespass on the privacy of individuals for no good purpose other than to intimidate or harass others. So,
yeah. In other words, every phone call, every conversation, every electronic transmission is in some way, shape, or form by somebody else monitored. You don't do that. Thank you.
This is the thing, you see, that I'm conducting these studies in a historic time when we live in a surveillance society, a de facto surveillance society. And of course, with the introduction of drone surveillance in the United States, that's pending now. 20,000 drones flying over the country. It's only intensifying. So it may be easy to misidentify my intent as party to, NSA illegal wiretapping, et cetera, but I simply don't participate in those types of ethics. I'm someone who came from a deep and profound spiritual background, practices in meditation. I'm someone who takes a daily oath to harmlessness. So I'm looking at enabling and empowering individuals in a way that will help to create a better society for everybody, where we don't need paranoia and fear as the foundations of our social interactions, but rather we can learn to trust ourselves and learn to trust the goodness in others. And that's really what I'm behind. So I hope that listeners will not confuse these studies with those invasive works that are contrary to those kinds of principles.
Do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
Do you have these in a 7.5?
How's that cooked?
Can I get that shipped overnight?
Is there a direct flight?
How long does the warranty last?
What's your soup of the day?
How do you change the ringtone?
Does it come in blue?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life.
Is it raining out?
What time's the meeting?
How much does this cost?
Does it have four-wheel drive?
Have we met before?
What's my account balance?
Yet somehow, when we get to the doctor's office... Any questions?
No.
We clam up. Ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
When do I get my results?
Questions lead to better healthcare. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How'd you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years in the police academy helped figure it out, but between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep-a-rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hey, what's up? Thinking about you. XOXOXO. Want to snuggle. Dot, dot, dot. JK. Hit me back. You getting these texts? Question mark. We should hang later. I miss you. Holla at ya, boy. Holla back. Holla back. Holla back. Are you at home? Where are you? What are you doing? OMG. You are making me mad. Are you with your ex? You better text me back. I'm waiting outside your house.
Relentless, aggressive texting is like sending an angry robot to deliver your message.
When does the robot become dangerous? Let us know at thatsnotcool.com.
Thatsnotcool.com.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hey there, it's Wendy, and we're back. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Happened to redirect because the Skype kind of bailed. I have no idea. It's making some funky sound in the background, and it totally kicked us off. But John Kelly is still here. Thank you, John, for being a good sport.
That's just great. So I'd like to talk a little bit about a case that I investigated related to the BTK killer in Wichita, Kansas. And this was a major regional story in the U.S. At that time, at the beginning of the millennium. The history was that a serial killer had been active in Wichita, Kansas in the 1970s. And these were atrocious crimes involving torture and murdering people in their own homes, home invasion, and so on. The known killer was taunting the police and local journalists with letters which described the scene of the crime in a way that only someone who had been present during those events would know about, and the police were thereby able to verify that the person writing those letters was the authentic killer. The crime subsided by the 1980s and became reactive again in the late 90s, and a gentleman named Dennis Rader was held on suspicion in a county jail in the early part of the millennium by police. So that was where I picked up the story. And Mr. Rader had given an interview to local television from the county jail. So he's talking by telephone, and we can hear his voice. He's talking about preparing for a hearing in front of a judge. Here's what he had to say.
So now that party is going to be subpoenaed in, or has been subpoenaed in. We cannot talk to that party. They can't come here for visits.
And is that audio level substantial?
I can hear it. Yes.
Yeah, I see if I can. I don't know if I can generate some more volume here. All right. And so, played in reverse, I heard the words, "The demons influence that guy." Well,
okay.
I thought this was unusual. I had mentioned earlier that I had been working as a clinician. I had worked with a number of individuals, and it was not common to find such messages relating to demons. I thought it was striking and odd. And this is where I began to trace back the history of the BTK killings and those letters that I had mentioned earlier. Because within those letters, the known BTK killer, the individual who police had authenticated as the individual involved in these crimes, also wrote to police and journalists that he felt that he was possessed by a demon. And so what were the odds that Dennis Rader, being held in the county jail, and the known killer would both have a connection to this type of thematic material?
Huge.
I thought the striking, parallel
that's
was
a really,
very
yeah.
striking. And so I went on the air at the request of a local radio station on Wichita Morning Radio 15 minutes before Dennis Rader was scheduled for his hearing. And I gave this report, this and other messages, from my study of his interview. I aired it in Wichita, in the city that was affected by those events. And 15 minutes later, Dennis Rader appeared before a judge, ostensibly for a hearing. But he turned the event into an hour-long confession, and he confessed to all of the BTK crimes at the pretrial hearing. And I was there 15 minutes prior, by telephone, of course, but I was on the air in Wichita with this information prior to the confession. I ID'd Dennis Rader due to this parallelism, this thematic material delivered in an unconscious way and detected through a process of reflection that compared Dennis Rader to the BTK killer. But that wasn't all. Because 2 weeks after his confession, Dennis Rader was being prepared to serve time for the BTK killings, and he gave a final jailhouse interview to the same television station. This is what Mr. Rader had to say in his own words.
I just know it's the dark side of me that it controls me. I personally think it's demons.
Let's play that just again. I know the sound quote levels here are a little lower.
Yeah, go ahead.
I actually think it's a demon.
He thinks it's a demon.
Right.
Dennis Rader, in his own words, is talking about demonic confession. He says he feels that he's possessed by a demon. And this was the information that I was able to detect through this decryption method using reflection of his speech signal from thousands of miles away. So the speaker himself, in this feedback loop, verified the statements that I uttered and reported on Wichita Morning Radio prior to the confession. And this is testimony to the scientific nature of these phenomena, in that they can be verified through real-world feedback. And this was done in a public way. This was done, I issued my report, you know, as a matter of public record. It was witnessed by however many hundreds of thousands of listeners were listening to morning radio that day. So it's uncontestable that these events occurred. It's a matter of historic record, publicly witnessed and documented by independent third parties. So you can begin to see why it was that CBS took such an interest in my work and were quick to promote me to a feature producer position and other things, such as, you know, flying me around the country to help them increase their Nielsen ratings on their 11 o'clock newscasts. So all those things happen as a consequence of this type of reporting.
It's fascinating. It really is fascinating. I find it interesting that we're getting a little bit of a hit here on the lines, because usually I don't get into content that is this intense. I stay away from the dark side, all right? And because of this very thing, it tends to mess with all sorts of stuff. And whether you believe it or not, that's my view of the world and what happens for me. So maybe it's just self, you know, in other words, I'm self-projecting and self-creating, self-manifesting. But, you know, you have to have a way to work your path and a way to listen to the universe and listen to all of the guides that are around you. And we all develop our own shortcuts. You've very, very much improved, I think, a view of seeing the world through this backward speech, reverse speech technology that's fascinating and that gives people an idea that just because it isn't mainstream doesn't mean it doesn't work. It means somebody's taken the time to hone it into a skill. You said you came from a background where every day you say, I do no harm, I practice do no harm. I just want to mention, that's huge when it comes to this kind of work, because there are those out there on a higher plane, in my experience, that look for that. And you will connect with a greater level of being and awareness when you use that as a mantra. It's just, I wanted you, how did you come to that place in your life where that became a daily prayer, a daily affirmation?
Well, I was someone who was deeply involved in yoga and meditation studies, consciousness and spirituality, and traditional Ashtanga yoga, Bhagavad Gita, Patanjali, these types of studies, South Asian spiritual sciences. And what's interesting in relation to these speech studies is that those methods that were taught from thousands of years in the past relied on human speech and the utterance of Sanskrit mantras. And so this is something that is still not well understood in the West in physics and other sciences, but I have produced very interesting research in this area as well. Photographic research, actually. So the power of mantra is recognized as the linking or the bridge between the human consciousness and cosmic consciousness in South Asian spiritual practices, which I studied extensively. I studied under monks.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. If you study the work of Dr. Emoto, then anybody who has seen the work that he's done with water and the vibration, the crystals, the speech, it's right there. It isn't rocket science. It's easy to get this kind of response when you're paying attention and you're looking. Being around the Tibetan monks when the Drepung monks who are doing the world tour, and they do their initial invocation, and they go in and they set the sand as they're making this. They do certain mantras and sounds as they set this with their intent, and then they release it with a blessing ceremony. Anybody who is there is impacted by those sounds, whether they know it or not. This stuff is incredibly effective and powerful. It's just in the Western world, we haven't had the exposure to it, and we think it is mumbo-jumbo, or it's like singing a song from the Beatles. It doesn't have an impact, yet it does. And I think that's what you're able to bring out with your reverse speech, is say, pay attention, kiddos. There's more here than meets the eye, and you have a lot more clues right in front of you that you have yet to discover. Where
is
the next?
This is related to, you know, human performance, human behavior, all of these developmental areas that people are interested in. Speech itself is a powerful instrument for human development, absolutely. And speaking of Dr. Emoto, I think it's important for listeners to understand that those widely read works and, you know, beautifully photographed water ice crystals that they developed in their lab. I expanded actually upon that body of work in a very special way, because I produced, I used mantra to constrain water in a in macro scale phenomena that could be recorded on cameras. And in fact, I've published in more of an informal way, but I've distributed throughout my work is my photography, even for those who, Wendy, like yourself, who may be on Facebook, even right now, if you go to my Facebook page, my personal page for John Kelly, and you look at the cover photo, well, that's water constrained by mantra into an iconic form on a macro scale. It's not microscopic. We don't need a lab to see the form. It's macro scale. It's on a human scale. It's a large scale form. It's breath condensation during the recital of mantra. And I don't know if you are on Facebook right now.
I'm looking at it right now, and I don't know whoever they can. Yeah, they can join us. But that's the image that looks almost like a snake.
Reptilian image. In fact, in the Hindu tradition, that would be a turtle, and one of the avatars of Vishnu. This would be the equivalent in Orthodox Christianity of an iconic painting of Madonna and Child, for example. But in the Hindu tradition, so this is a Vaishnava avatar, and it's one in a series that I photographed. And the forms emerged spontaneously during the recital of Sanskrit mantras. So I was able to demonstrate, without the aid of any institutions or fancy laboratory equipment, just using off-the-shelf cameras, I was able to demonstrate the potential of the human voice to constrain matter in such a way on a macro scale, not a microscopic, just macro scale photography, large scale phenomena. It's my breath condensation. It's water suspended in the air. It's the sound waves of the human voice. And to further complicate or perhaps parallel back to the speech studies, the photograph is resolved through the use of reflection. So we're not in a visual media today, and it's difficult to, you know, this is more tangible for someone who simply sees the images, but they're scattered throughout my publications, my videos, and right on my Facebook page, John Kelly, J-O-N-K-E-L-O-Y. Just look at my cover photo. There you go. Dr. Emoto on a macro scale.
That's, yeah, and I was going to say that might, yeah, be more like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle now that I look at it.
in the Hindu tradition, that's Kurma, the avatar of Vishnu, one of the multiple avatars. And I have a series of these formed in the same way, but only difference, one of them is a plasma as opposed to water. But I'm demonstrating the constraint of water into intelligent designs through the recital of mantras on a macro scale without a lab to do it with. I just did it in nature. You see, all of these phenomena that I'm interested in, really, one of the points that people can take away from my discussion is about the accessibility of cosmic scale phenomena at a human level. Even Stone Age people could participate in these activities without the aid of any kind of major technological innovations. I didn't have a university funding me. I didn't have any, you know, General Electric funding. I didn't have any of those things. I did it all
on a... No, wait a second.
Consumer,
I want to go back and reverse
salary.
That. They were doing it first. the indigenous people who have all of these experiences and the shaman and all this, you know, before we got to our, it can't be done unless it's tested in a lab and produced with some high-powered, fancy, you know, falutin equipment. And, yeah, you're just bringing it back to the people and saying, kids, look, here.
So this is really, you know, one of the powerful messages I have to share is that the average person has incredible potential, and we simply need to enable that and cultivate it and to want that more, perhaps, than other endeavors that we spend our time on. The human potential is massive, and it's completely, we haven't begun to express or realize that in our society, and here we are with so much potential waiting to express. My work only really paves the way for others to say, look within yourself. You know, even as a clinician, when people are trying to solve intractable problems in their personal lives, I'm saying you also have the solution within you. It can express from within you as well. My work demonstrates that. All of my works are really about that. It's about enabling and showing, just being acting as a guide in a way to show these frontiers of opportunity and experience are within the grasp of all of us. You don't need to be a high priest of any particular philosophy or point of view or ideology. We don't need that. We need what's within us, and that it's waiting to express. It's really within our reach.
Part of it, though, is to focus your mind, and what you've developed are tools. You have different tools that you have been able to access and then capitalize on and bring into, you know, up to a higher plane. That's what I think is missing, you know, here. There's no real schooling in how to become more trusting of this unseen world and to do exactly what you're doing. People will go, oh, that's just the fluke, blah, blah. And no, it isn't. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's that conscious intent, and you are focusing your thought to create a manifest result of some kind, and then allowing that to be what it is so you get the real picture instead of something you're projecting on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so you can see I took very dramatic steps to bring my work to public attention. I undertook severe risks, personal risks, in order to ensure that all of the benefits that I was receiving personally would translate into a public benefit in terms of educational opportunities and you know, inspiration for others. I took tremendous personal risk. I made very intensive sacrifices and exposed myself to significant danger in order to do so. And so I can be said that I felt very strongly about, you know, creating some kind of a legacy, you know, doing some kind of trailblazing with the sense that it would be of long-term benefit to society if generations today were unable to make sense out of my work, that future generations would have the opportunity to review and would be able to do something with it.
Well, I think in my opinion, I'm assuming you're alluding to the information you brought out about Mr. Bush. That would be a very dangerous kind of accusation or implication to just put that out there and say, hey, this is what was happening, and they knew it a long time before it became
public. Breaching
public.
Pentagon security would generally be considered, intelligence and information security would mm-hmm. be generally considered a risky activity. But I was
yeah.
supported by the media infrastructure, which itself is part of the military. So there were people green-lighting me and red-flagging me both at the same time.
Yeah. I'm sure they were all over you. And that's the thing, though. This information, this way of getting, you know, anomalous and alternative views of reality is something that people are still trying to figure out and bring to the public. Because if you get somebody, unlike yourself, who has more of a either a mercenary or some kind of a totalitarian or dictator type viewpoint, somebody who has no empathy, somebody who's more sociopathic and has this to, you know, at their access, they're not going to come to the same conclusion to you that all of this is going to serve a purpose for the benefit of society. They're going to be more self-motivated. And that's what makes it scary.
So this is a time when we have access to incredible technologies. I mean, North American society is very advanced in so many ways. There's so many resources concentrated here that allows for different kinds of arts and sciences to be practiced that can't be done anywhere else in the world. But in spite of all this abundance of opportunity, we're called upon as a society to address ethical issues, more fundamental and simple moralistic issues, and not to preach morality to people or browbeat them with morality. But we are facing fundamental ethical challenges that will make the difference between the type of future that we can create or not. In yoga, there's something called the moral shakti, which means that people who say what they think and do what they say, they act in integrity, they behave in integrative ways. Those people, the more they tell the truth, the more their words become true, and they gain this force in life, this occult power, so to speak, of morality actually supports them. And so we're by abandoning morality in so many different ways, important ways in our mass as a culture. And I'm referring to things like torture, illegal surveillance. By abandoning morality, we're throwing away this wealth of potential that we could quickly reclaim if we would refuse to go further along those types of paths. It's so simple. This is not high tech at all. I'm saying that it's actually the ethics of our time that are the key issue. So even those who've been empowered with access to super secret resources and high technologies that are beyond human comprehension for the average person, it all comes down to ethics and morality. That's the question of our time. And will we successfully navigate those questions? Will we take a sum of the issues and responsibilities that come with the burden of knowledge and apply it in the best way possible? This is the question of our time, and we must, as a society, we must err on the side of morality rather than abandonment of principles and corruption of values. We can't continue along a path like that.
Okay, now your work has brought you into a whole new arena, working with extraterrestrial, UFO, paranormal. that kind of content. And to me, that is absolutely on the edge, and it's exactly where I want to be, because that's our future. So what, in terms of evolution of your information and content, what direction are you going with this?
Well, I'm working now with people who are contactees and abductees who are attempting to reclaim missing time incidents and retrace the path of, you know, of their contacts to better understand and resolve, you know, perhaps some of the traumatic dimensions that may be implied through that. Abduction is typically a human rights issue. But let's listen to a famous abductee, Betty Hill, whose testimony was in part the basis of The Interrupted Journey, a famous book that became a television movie in the 1970s that really brought the issue of abduction to public awareness in North America. It was the first nationally prominent abduction case. Here she's talking about, for those who aren't familiar with the Hills and their abduction, they were driving south from Canada in the Northeast at night, returning home after a vacation, and they were being tracked by an object in the sky. This is her testimony related to that incident.
Yes, a body there in World War II. He knows planes. And he's trying to identify them. And it's flying in a very erratic manner, which was very puzzling to us. But this is 61. We heard UFOs. Well, actually, in those days, they called them flying saucers. We had no idea what a flying saucer looked like. But we had no fear. Just curiosity, we were trying to identify this craft.
All right. And so the story that she told so many times, this is from an interview that was published to YouTube in the early recorded in the early 1990s. She'd been telling the story for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So played backwards, what do we find? You know, Dr. Chael and Hynek said that Blue Book, the Project Blue Book, the Air Force investigation, was a cover-up in part because there was no innovation and methodology for examining witness testimony or improvements in the interrogation of witnesses. Here we are in the 21st century responding to these legacy scientists and their desire for improved methodology to interrogate the UFO witnesses, because we can see through reflection that the testimonies are rich in additional information that may or may not be known. Here I hear the words from Betty Hill. She says the words, "The saucer, I'll block it."
Yeah.
And why is it that someone would want to block a saucer if it was the case, as indicated by Barney Hill, that the Hills were traumatized through their abduction? Then perhaps this incident would be something that would be uncomfortable for them to remember. They would want to block the memory of the encounter with the saucer. And so why is this significant? Because for those who continue to claim that Betty Hill and Barney Hill were fabricating the entire incident, it doesn't make any sense for somebody to continue to talk about something that gives them such apparent discomfort, and that discomfort is indicated through such involuntary behavior. It's not contrived. It's our unconscious indicating this. And I know it's the unconscious mind. How do I know? Because my findings are consistently verified. As demonstrated earlier on our show, the Iraq War did manifest in such a way. Dennis Rader was, in fact, the BTK killer, and he said in his own words that he was possessed by a demon. That's the level of authenticity that I'm bringing now to these controversial studies that will continue to be a controversy as part of the cover-up of the entire, you know, contact and UFO incident. I'm attempting to focus some of this clarity, proven, demonstrated clarity on this topic by these restudies of the witness testimonies. Here's another individual, and I know we're getting close to time, but this is a good story to focus on as well. Wendell Stevens, the famed UFO investigator, I think former Air Force colonel, who passed in recent years, was party to all kinds of investigations and claimants coming forward to, you know, send him photography or testimony. Well, one individual who came to his attention in the early 1990s went under the name Connor O'Ryan, and this was again published to YouTube. And in fact, I know personally individuals who were on site during this incident, which took place in Arizona. It connects Wendell Stevens and his circle at that time. A number of prominent ufology people
were connected to the story. I know one of those people in person who is a resident of the Vancouver area. She was there at the time. She saw all of this go down. Connor O'Ryan claimed that he was a security guard at Area 51, or S4, mm-hmm. and that he was tasked with guarding recovered flying saucers that were stored underground. I don't know, Wendy, if you remember the movie The Andromeda Strain from 1971.
Yeah.
It's a famous story. At the time, Crichton, I think, was the author. It's about an alien life form that comes to Earth and is sequestered away in an underground base outside of Las Vegas. You see, Area 51 was in the public culture in the movies in 1971, although unless you were an insider, you had no idea what they were talking about. They were talking about Area 51 in the Andromeda Strain. It's about an alien in an underground base outside Las Vegas. So here is Connor O'Ryan coming forward saying, I'm a sentry working this shift. I'm a SEAL. I'm an assassin. I'm this. I'm that. I've got to get out of this. I've got to escape from the system because they're going to assassinate me because I know too much. This is what he brought to Wendell Stevens. Here's part of the interview that he gave by the roadside. It's crappy audio, unfortunately, but here's what he said forwards. Just going to audio here.
Well, we had ride to Nellis, and at Nellis we'd ride for about another hour, stop for about 20 minutes.
Okay, he's talking about furlough to Las Vegas, and then his crew would go back to the base to go back to work. And play backwards, I heard him say, the ride ended up with their deep sign. And why is this significant? Because it's a psychological archetype. He's saying that when he went to the base where the ETs were residing and the saucers were being stored, he said there was a psychological archetype, a deep sign that was associated with that location. He's talking about the psychology of contact and the interdimensional nature of contact. He's describing it in terms of a deep sign or an archetype. The ride back to the base where the ETs were was associated with a deep psychological process. This authenticates his testimony. And so here are the witnesses making claims, and in the minds of some public, this is all highly imaginative, but there's no possible way in my mind that through such an involuntary method, they could disclose more revealing information pertaining to these claims and seemingly validating their statements, unless, in fact, these incidents were true and these things were actually taking place. So this is just a little bit of insight into the nature of my work. I've tested and demonstrated my work outside of ufology, in the public eye, covering major news events, national, international scale, and to the prominence of CBS feature producer. So now I'm taking those demonstrated skills and applying them in one of the world's most controversial topics, not only as a student of the contactees' testimonies, but as a videographer as well. I've been on site. I have a very large archive of my own personal UFO videos that were shot with other witnesses with multi-camera setups and so on. So I continue to blaze trails and work on the front lines of information and education. And I hope that this little bit of insight I was able to share today was helpful to some of the listeners.
I think it will be, and I would like to get you back again, and hopefully next time we'll have less trouble with the equipment. But we do want to close. John, your website for people to connect with you, your inner voice.
Yourinnervoice.com, or call me toll-free, 1-888-453-0751. 1-888-453-0751, yourinnervoice.com.
Well, it's been a very fascinating look at what John Kelly does. Check him out on YouTube. Just Google if you want to and find out and call the line he just gave you. I appreciate you listening. This is Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett on Empower Radio.